It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, after the first Democratic primary debate last night, Harry Enten joins us for a weekly look at the latest in national politics.
First, a jury announced their verdict late yesterday that Badger Guns and its owners were liable in the shooting of two Milwaukee police officers. The trial has been going on for the last 3 weeks and attracted national attention. The verdict includes almost $6 million in damages to the officers, and there will be an appeal.
John Diedrich has been reporting on this case. He joins us again to talk about it. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let refresh us on the basics, John. Talk us through what was at issue in this trial.
Well, this circulates around a shooting that happened in 2009. Two Milwaukee police officers were shot in the head, seriously injured during a stop on the near south side of Milwaukee. The investigation showed that the gun had been sold by Badger Guns a month earlier in what turned out to be a straw purchase. That's where somebody buys a gun for somebody else.
And the idea here is that the officers were trying to prove that Badger Guns was in part liable for the shooting and get financial compensation. So what did we hear from the jury? What did they decide in terms of compensation and awards here?
Right, that's a good summary of the case. They were alleging from the beginning that the gun store was negligent in its sales practices, that in fact it had broken the law five different ways, and that it negligently put the gun in the hands of the straw buyer. That's what the jury found. In four out of the five cases, they found that the gun store broke the law, that they knew or should have known that the individual that they were selling to was not the actual buyer of the gun. And then they also found delivered punitive damages against the store of $750,000. So the nearly $6 million in awards are compensatory damages that cover medical lost wages, future wages, pain and suffering, and then these punitive damages as well.
And this case has gotten national attention. Why are people looking at this trial and maybe seeing it as a precedent for other lawsuits?
Well, there's a federal law that was passed 10 years ago that made these kinds of cases all but extinct. It granted broad immunity to firearms dealers and manufacturers, though it does have exceptions, and under those exceptions is how this case was brought and ultimately made it to trial and a jury's verdict. This is only the second case nationwide to go to trial. There was one in Alaska earlier this year in which the jury found in favor of the gun store. So this is the first finding by a jury in favor of plaintiffs against a gun dealer in the United States since the law passed in 2005.
So the bar is very high for someone who's the victim of some kind of shooting to even get this thing into trial, much less to get the verdict they're looking for.
Yeah, that's right. Usually these cases end up getting dismissed if they don't have facts like were present in this case. In other words, allegations and proof that the law was actually broken. In this case, some of the proof that was most damning to the gun store was video from in-store surveillance cameras and so forth that showed that there were a lot of questions around these sales.
Talking to John Diedrich, he's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Looking at the ruling yesterday from a jury in the Badger gun case, finding that gun store liable for providing a gun that was used in the shooting of two Milwaukee police officers. We'll talk about the specific kinds of negligence that the officers and their attorney were trying to prove and that the jury, for by and large, agreed with. Where did the gun store go wrong?
Well, what happened here is that Jacob Collins is the buyer of the gun. He comes into the store in May of 2009. He's 21 years old. He comes in with another individual by the name of Julius Burton, who is 18. And at 18, Julius Burton is not old enough to buy a handgun from a store. So Collins is the straw buyer in this case, Burton the actual purchaser of the gun. The video that was shown during testimony and during the trial was that Collins, as he was filling out forms, Burton sort of hanging over his shoulder. Collins is having trouble during filling out the form. He actually marks at one point that he is not the actual buyer of the gun, which experts said should have been a stop sign right there for the sale going ahead. The clerk allowed him to change his answer. There also was video surveillance that showed that the actual buyer, Burton, who ultimately shot the officers later, is seen pointing out the gun that he wanted and said, according to Collins, that's the one I want. So these indicators, it's known as red flags, if you will, of a straw buy, were very persuasive to the jury as I spoke to jurors after the case.
There's also a conspiracy allegation as part of this lawsuit. What was that about, and was that part of this jury's decision?
So this question did go before the jury. The question was, Badger Outdoors and Badger Guns are the two names of entities that occupied the same location in West Milwaukee for nearly 20 years. And I should add that these are gun shops that have accounted for the majority of crime guns that are recovered by police in the Milwaukee area. And Badger Outdoors was actually the largest supplier of crime guns in the nation for a number of years. So the case here was questioning whether Badger Outdoors essentially transferred their business that they were in fear of losing by federal regulation to Badger Guns. This is basically two members of the same family, and when one license was turned in by the father, the son pulled out his own license. So the conspiracy count was saying essentially they were trying to defeat federal regulators and keep an illegal gun sales operation going. The jury said in that case that they did not find in the favor of the plaintiff, so they rejected that claim.
I want to follow up that crime gun issue as a bit of a sidebar. You've reported on that in the past. Back when we had data, a lot of guns used in crimes were traced, as you say, back to Badger Guns. We don't have that data anymore, as I understand it. The federal law has changed. That's no longer collectible, findable data.
Yeah, well, it's still collected. It's not released publicly, and it cannot be easily shared as it was among law enforcement agencies before. This goes back to the so-called Tehart Amendment that was instituted about 11 years ago now. This also came out of, this was another reaction, a second one, in addition to this federal law, in reaction to these lawsuits that were coming in. And what this said was that the ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives, could not release any trace data totals about any gun stores nationwide. And if they did, they would lose funding from Congress. So they made it very clear, got the attention of the ATF. And there were other restrictions on this. And the effect of that has been that largely we've been in the dark as to how many gun traces individual stores have. We have learned sort of here and there about it because of lawsuits or pieces of information that come out, but it's not as systematically shared as it was before. And the concern for law enforcement is that they don't have as wide of access to be able to talk to, say, neighboring jurisdictions to find out, well, what are you finding out with your gun traces in your jurisdiction, and how can we learn about how guns are moving by comparing our traces.
As I understand it, the two officers in this case aren't the only ones injured by weapons traced back to Badger Guns. Are we expecting suits from other police officers?
Well, there has been another lawsuit that's been filed. There were six police officers who were wounded by guns from either Badger Outdoors or Badger Guns in a 20-month period. This is back in 2008, 9, and into 10. And during that period, none of these officers were killed, but these two officers were among the most seriously wounded. There's two more officers who filed suit, same lawyers involved, and that case is scheduled to go to trial here in Milwaukee next year in May. Yet to see if it's going to go to trial, but that's the schedule right now.
So the gun store owners, as I understand it, planning an appeal. Any idea of a timeline where this could ultimately go?
Well, we're looking for an appeal, and that's true. They are going to appeal, and it's going to be early next year. We expect an appeal. This will stay in state court. It'll go most likely through the appeals court. It could go directly to the state Supreme Court. There is a path where it could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court, which very rarely takes such any cases, but it may take this case because it does involve a federal law. The larger question, as I'm talking to experts today, is what sort of effect this might have beyond Wisconsin. Because we have a certain set of facts that happened here, you know, different cases have different facts, and we just have a Wisconsin case. What I'm hearing from experts is they're saying they expect plaintiffs will at least probably consider filing if they didn't before, because they could see that the case could be successful. It was in Milwaukee. And they might also look to see, well, how was that case and that law, how was it interpreted? Because there are certain definitions that have really never been tested in trial. And this was the first time that these questions were put before a jury that then found in favor of the plaintiff.
John, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Diedrich, reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was with us to talk about the ruling in the Badger Guns case just announced late yesterday.
It's our weekly look at the latest in national politics with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst at 538. Last night was the first Democratic primary debate, the general consensus, Hillary Clinton coming away the winner. But what result is it likely to have in the polls?
We also stand 3 short weeks away from the date that Congress will need to raise the debt limit in order to keep the government running. Amid the scramble, the majority party, the Republicans, still don't have a clear path to replacing John Boehner as House Speaker.
Harry Enten joins us now. Harry, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Harry, Democrats had their first primary debate last night. You were watching it. What'd you think?
I think that, this is an example where the media probably overcorrected. So we were going into this debate, Hillary Clinton's in trouble, a lot of pundits believe. But I think if you looked at most of the measures going in, she was in strong position in the polls. She had the most endorsements. She had the most money. And, yeah, she had a good night last night, but I think Bernie Sanders also had a good night. I think most of the candidates on that stage weren't disasters. I think Lincoln Chafee might have bordered on it, where he basically mentioned that he voted for something not knowing what it was. But I think most of the candidates did well last night, but Hillary Clinton going in this debate was the prohibitive favorite, and she still is. I will say one thing, though, and that is I look at that debate last night. I think most people look at that debate and say, where was Joe Biden, and does Joe Biden really have a path going forward if he wants to get in? And I think most people would answer that question with no. But we'll see where we are in a few days and weeks.
Yeah, I think you wrote that if there was a loser last night, that loser was Joe Biden. Does that mean when you're talking about him having a path in, are you saying that last night someone would have self-imploded and that would leave him an opening?
Right, exactly. So, Joe Biden is not somebody like Bernie Sanders who has real cred with very liberal Democrats. But he is somebody who has been in the Democratic Party for a long time. He was a 40-year or 35-year senator. He was a vice president for 2 terms. And he's somebody who could connect with the party actors in a way Bernie Sanders, who is not an elected Democrat, could. But the only way that he really has a shot at winning is if Hillary Clinton were to fall apart. And Clinton clearly did not do that last night. I think she reassured people who are worrying about the email scandal that she is here to stay. And, I just don't really see how Biden, unless something happens, Biden can get in and mount a credible campaign, or at least one in which he could possibly win.
And we're going to talk about the particulars from the debate a little later in the show, but I want to ask you one moment that the media loves to clip the most is where Bernie Sanders, some people say, handed her a gift and said, enough about the emails already. Let's move on to stuff of substance. Was that a big moment, do you think?
I think it's a huge moment, because Bernie Sanders, if he wants to win without Joe Biden in the race, has to chip away at Hillary Clinton's support, because she's over 50% in the polls. And if you're over 50% in the polls, you're going to win. And so Sanders needs to chip away at Clinton's support if he wants a chance without Biden in the race. And last night pretty much showed that, and that particular moment showed that he's not very comfortable going on the attack unless it's centered around income inequality. And to me, Sanders is a candidate who clearly has a very strong message that appeals to a large minority of liberal Democrats, but not a message that is going to be able to transform this primary into one that's truly competitive.
And do you think that her win last night is going to signal sort of a turning of the tide? She was already, it sounds like, starting to turn around a little bit in terms of some of the numbers, but in terms of polls, is this going to be a pivot point?
I think, if you looked at the polls heading in, she was already, as you said, she was sort of making a turn. She had sort of bottomed out and maybe even climbed a few points in the national polls. I think where this is a real pivot point is with the media. And the media has been going after Clinton for a few months now because they need a story. The Republican side has a story in Donald Trump, but the Democratic side really doesn't have sort of an overarching story that's, quote-unquote, sexy to cover. And so last night, though, if you watch all the media response, it was Clinton's coming back, Clinton's doing great again. It was a pivot away from the negative email stories. So in that degree, it certainly helped her. But in terms of the overarching sort of, you know, where Clinton is in this race in the polls and where she is with endorsements and money. Those things are still the same. Bernie Sanders isn't going anywhere. Clinton isn't going anywhere. But that race, as it was one in which Hillary Clinton was and is the prohibitive favorite to win the Democratic nomination.
I'm talking to Harry Enten right now, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics. And we're going to move on now to the ongoing saga of the search for the next Speaker of the House. We thought it was going to be for a while Kevin McCarthy, and that abruptly ended. And then we had the name Paul Ryan, and that's the one that's still out there right now from Wisconsin. Where is that right now?
I tell you, this Speaker race is something that really makes all of us take a step back and say, maybe we don't know everything. We don't know what we're talking about. You know, when we spoke last week, it looked like Kevin McCarthy was going to be the next Speaker of the House. And now all of a sudden, he is certainly not going to be the next Speaker of the House. And John Boehner is still the Speaker of the House and is the Speaker of the House for, you know, the future, at least the imminent future as we see it. Who is it going to be? I mean, Paul Ryan's name has certainly been floated. He's somebody who, you know, at least by the traditional measures, a hard rock conservative, someone who could appeal. But again, he doesn't seem to want it. And if he doesn't want it, they can't force him to do it. He still has a say. This is a free country. And so, you know, they're going to keep the pressure on Ryan, but the list of speakers grows ever longer. I mean, from the state of Texas alone, there are four potential people who are being floated, and that may grow. So I just not sure that we really can handicap this right now. If Ryan gets in, then, yeah, he would be the prohibitive favorite, but he has shown no real signs of getting in despite numerous appeals from many party elders.
So just to play this out, let's say Ryan says, no, I'm not in. Maybe he's got presidential ambitions, doesn't want to make enemies, whatever his story is there. Let's say you've got this huge long laundry list of potential candidates. What does that mean? How does that play out then?
I mean, it sort of plays out in the way that the House Republican caucus has seemed to play out over the past years. It's a mess. And out of a mess, I don't know what necessarily rises. You know, we just haven't really seen anything like this before. I mean, I guess maybe you would want to say the late 90s when you had the Gingrich sort of transition and you ended up with Hastert as the speaker. Maybe that was sort of similar. But, you know, I don't think many people would have thought that Dennis Hastert was going to become the Speaker of the House after all of that. So I think it's very difficult to handicap right now. I think there are any number of names that could possibly be. But I think what will need to be is someone who really does appeal across the party at this point. I think that it's going to have to be somebody, perhaps it's an unknown person, who can satisfy the Freedom Caucus, but is also somebody who can satisfy mainstream Republicans. I don't know who that is. I don't know if anyone knows who that is, and if it was so obvious, I think we'd say it. But right now, it's just a race that's very difficult to handicap unless Paul Ryan gets in.
Well, and given John Boehner's pretty apparent glee with leaving and the difficulty of getting someone else to step in, is it fair to draw the conclusion that at this point in history, this is not a great gig?
I think that, you know, look, being Speaker of the House is a great gig in so far of being, you know, you're somebody, you're very high up in government, but it's an impossible gig because you have to realize, as we said last week, you have a Senate that is, although Republicans are in control, they don't have the 60 votes necessary to really move legislation. You have a Democratic president, and meanwhile, you have a House Republican caucus, at least a sizable portion of it, that doesn't want to really compromise with the Democrats in the Senate or President Obama. So a speaker where you're trying to move legislation, it's pretty much impossible. That's why we really don't see any large pieces of legislation moving, and you see the government moving forward. It's been able to pay its bills so far, but beyond that, it really hasn't been able to do much of anything, and I'm not sure it's going to be able to do much of anything going forward.
We're going to wrap up now talking about some possible outcomes of the upcoming debt ceiling and government spending bill deadlines. What are things we should be looking for here?
I think this is going to be a story. Look, we still have some time to go. It's not until early November. I believe it's November 5th when the Treasury Department says that, you know, we need to get, what is it, $118 trillion. We have to raise the debt ceiling above that. So we still have time. What I think we'll see a number of things that go forward. This is going to be competing with the race for the speaker, whether or not John Boehner can help move it through, whether we're going to even have a new speaker by the time that happens. These are unknowns. I mean, I'm not particularly worried about where the Senate's going to be. I think the Senate's going to be fine, but the House Republican caucus, whether there are enough votes there to be able to raise the ceiling, something that isn't necessarily very popular with Republican voters in their congressional districts, still unknown. I think that they probably will. We haven't seen any major crises that went unaddressed by this House Republican caucus. But if the last few weeks have taught us anything, it's that we need to take a step back and not assume anything with regards to this House Republican caucus.
And just very briefly, you know, is there an appeal there for the House Republicans to just hit pause and wait for that next speaker?
I think that there's going to be some appeal to that. But to be honest, as I said, I just don't think we know. I think we need to wait and see where we are in a week and 2 weeks and take it a day at a time.
Gotcha. Harry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
A senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time with the latest in national politics.
And by the way, you can share your thoughts on last night's Democratic Party presidential debate over at the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When it comes to business startup culture in Wisconsin, we hear a lot of things, often negative things, especially after it was reported this year that Wisconsin ranks dead last for startup activity in the nation.
But despite that distinction, our next guest says there's a lot of misinformation out there about Wisconsin's startup culture. He's looking to bust some of what he calls the most persistent myths.
Tom Still joins us now. He's the president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Veronica. Hi, Rob.
Well, Tom, before we get going into the myth-busting, what's your take on the current status of startup culture here in Wisconsin?
I think it is really healthy. It's and it varies a little bit sector to sector. And, of course, you know, with my role with Wisconsin Technology Council, I'm going to see more tech-based startups and tech-based emerging companies than companies that might be in some of the other sectors. But generally speaking, it is a healthy environment that looks way better than it did 10 or 15 years ago.
So when you say it's healthy, you still have looming out there this 50th out of 50 ranking. So when you give that health barometer of healthy, do you think that you're comparing it to how it was in the past, or what are you comparing it to?
Well, and you know, let's bear in mind with the 50th. That was one ranking. It was from the Kauffman Foundation, and they do good work around a lot of things. But, you know, stand back and think about that. Are we really 50th behind West Virginia or Mississippi or some of the other states you may think of? Not really. It's in part how they crunch the data. A lot of it has to do with entrepreneurs who leave one job to do a startup. That's not often the Wisconsin way. Often in Wisconsin, people are still working that day job, but they're involved in startups, and that may take place for a while before they really cut all the ties. So if you look at some of the other rankings that are out there, for example, the Milken Institute, we recently rose up to 18th in terms of some of their measures of tech-based startups, and that's from 36th just a few years before. So are we the best state for startups? No. But are we dead last? I would argue that's simply not the case. There are reasons we could and should do better, but I'd be willing to defend us as not being last any day of the week.
Okay, well, so let's get into these five myths that you recently wrote about. Myth number one, you write about, all entrepreneurial ventures are pretty much alike, so isn't there a template for success to be followed by all of them? So the template myth, Tom.
Yeah. And this begins with the fact that not all startups are alike. Some are the traditional mom-and-pop businesses that, you know, launch on Main Street, and they intend to stay there, succeed there, usually with not a lot of growth capital or even employees. And that's, you know, that's a bread-and-butter kind of thing for small business everywhere in the United States, so we're no different. Then other types are lifestyle businesses in which the owner turns a hobby or an avocation into a way to make money and while still having fun with it. And then social entrepreneurs are those who may turn a passion, whether it be environmentalism or education or helping children, into a business that pays the bills while still doing well by others. The area where we focus is what is generally referred to as a gazelle, meaning these are companies who want to grow quickly, then leap ahead of the competition, creating a lot of value and jobs along the way. And those are also the trickiest to fund and to grow, but they are the ones that often have the most potential.
Well, and myth number two, let's move on to that one now. You say one myth in Wisconsin, there isn't enough angel and venture capital in Wisconsin for the great emerging companies here. So where are we on things like venture capital in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, for starters, the best companies will find funding if they look hard enough and they make the right pitch and they're able to persuade investors that those investors can get a strong return on their dollars. We run something called the Wisconsin Early Stage Symposium, which is the oldest and largest venture fair, really, in Wisconsin. And that's going to happen in early November, and it really is an example of companies that will be there to put their best foot forward to investors. In fact, we'll have about 45 companies all told. And we're not California. We're not Boston. We're not even Minnesota in some ways when it comes to venture capital. But the gap is closing. Just a couple of recent years, 2013, there were 86 Wisconsin early-stage companies that raised about $130 million in angel and venture capital. Last year, 2014, it rose to 113 companies that did the same, and the total dollars more than doubled. And so far, 2015 is on track with 2014, if not better. So while it's not easy raising money, those companies really have to show value. It's getting better here in Wisconsin.
You said these entrepreneurs they need to make the right pitch and find the right match. Any advice about how to do that?
Well, I think many times tech-based entrepreneurs in a pitch, and these pitches can be in for example in our conference anywhere from 90 seconds for some companies to 5 minutes for others. They need to spend time on what is the value proposition. How will it make money? How will it serve a market need? How will it create new markets where perhaps none existed in the past? It's less about the technology and the gee whiz factor. Investors will get into that later on. That if there's a follow-up meeting, you know, the goal of a pitch is to get a meeting. And the investors will kick those kinds of tires when they get into a follow-up meeting and all the due diligence they do moving along. So it's something that happens later. So focus on the message of what's the market, what's the competition, how are you going to create value for those investors.
We're talking to Tom Still right now, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. He's talking about some of the top myths he sees surrounding startup culture in Wisconsin. And Tom, at number three, you say the myth is we're 50th in startups among 50 states, so Wisconsin must be unfriendly to new companies. You got at that a little. Anything else you want to say to bust that one?
Well, you know, and again, we talked a little bit about how some of these surveys measure what's going on in Wisconsin, and there are you know, different surveys and ratings that are going to do different things. At the end of the day, I think it's important to measure ourselves against ourselves. And if you look back 10 or 15 years in Wisconsin, the things that are created now that did not exist then, it speaks to the fact that we're really becoming a much better state when it comes to having startup companies and then keeping them alive. There were no angel investor tax credits 10 years ago. There was only one investment conference, which was ours. There was no entrepreneurs conference. There was no governor's business plan contest. There were very few support groups out there like ourselves to help entrepreneurs in terms of mentoring. There were only one or two campuses that had entrepreneurial programs. So all of that has really sprung up in the last 10 to 15 years. To make Wisconsin a much more friendly place for entrepreneurs of really all stripes.
And let's move along here to number four. You say, here's one that's out there. All of the technical and management talent is clustered on the coast, and then Wisconsin's a flyover state. So I guess basically the myth there is that even if you've got a great idea and some resources, you're not going to find the people power, the human resources to run your business. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Increasingly, there are some really good stories that counter that myth. That probably was true 15 years ago, because imagine yourself as a CEO coming to Wisconsin to help run a tech-based company here. Well, if it didn't work out, what are you going to do? You know, in the Silicon Valley or in Boston, you could fall out of your front door and walk down the street, and you'd probably find another company that's a good match. Here, that wasn't the case at the time, but now it is becoming so. The story of Exact Sciences, for example, two folks in Madison brought that company to Madison from Boston, and they were the only employees at the time. Today, they got 450 employees. Jamf Software in Eau Claire was started by a couple of UW Eau Claire graduates. Zach Homestead is one. He's going to speak at our conference. He was told repeatedly, you can't build a software company in the Chippewa Valley. You won't find enough good people. Well, they've got 400 people now in the Chippewa Valley and in the Twin Cities and sales around the world. And then, of course, there's Epic in Verona. It's up to about 9,000 people now. They have more than 50% of the national market share in electronic health records. And they attract people to Wisconsin every day. So we have reached the point where not only have we long had the scientific talent, we also have the management talent to help those companies grow.
Okay, we're going to wrap up with your last. You say that the policymakers in Wisconsin, this is the myth, just care about manufacturing, agriculture, and tourism. So why bother pursuing startups in information technology or life sciences? Mm-hmm. Where's that?
Yeah, they, state legislators that, at least that we speak with, and we attend different hearings and are asked to talk at different hearings or working groups in the Capitol. They increasingly understand that the technology is not just a silo. It's not just for geeks and scientists who work in wet labs. It's embedded in every core industry in Wisconsin, especially manufacturing, which is really had to become high-tech to survive. In agriculture, we have two events coming up that are about that, and tourism, where connectivity, broadband, and all of the other things that are around having the right messages on tourism are really important. So those are driving, technology is really driving some of our largest and most historic sectors. And the state, it's worth mentioning that it is a limited partner in the Badger Fund of Funds, which is now launching. It's a $25 million fund to be matched 2-1 by private dollars. And that, I think, was a strong signal that the state does support things. So could more happen? Could other things be passed by the legislature to improve the situation? Sure. But I think it's worth noting that they're increasingly very attentive.
Well, Tom, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Veronica.
That was Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. He joined us to talk about some of the top myths surrounding startup culture here in Wisconsin.
We're keeping the conversation going about startup culture in Wisconsin. Now we look at a new effort in northeastern Wisconsin to boost entrepreneurial efforts in the region.
Launch Wisconsin, which hosted a kickoff event last Wednesday, is a new group aimed at encouraging startups in Wisconsin, especially the Fox Valley, as well as finding solutions to existing business problems in the area.
Here to tell us more about the effort is John Ernst. He's executive director of Launch Wisconsin. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us how Launch Wisconsin was launched. What are you trying to do?
Well, we're trying to do a lot of things. But how it got launched into the world really was through a group of business leaders and businesses in northeast Wisconsin. I work for a ZyQuest Venture Center in De Pere, Wisconsin. Along with five other founding partners, we decided that we wanted to create something that complemented other events and other things going on in the state already. And we really wanted to speak to three groups. We wanted to speak to entrepreneurs, corporations, and investors and invite them to participate in our event and in a new way.
And talk us through the scene when it comes to entrepreneurship in northeast Wisconsin, Green Bay, the Fox Cities.
Well, the landscape that we see from our chair is we see the state really has a number of areas that are hotbeds for startup activity. You've got the Madison area, you've got the Milwaukee area, you've got the Northeast area, Northeast Wisconsin, New North area, and you've got some other areas that are outliers as well, Wausau and Eau Claire and La Crosse. But when we look at those areas, we really think of the state as a whole from our chair. We don't want to put ourselves in a position where we're looking at each independent location being competing in any way with one another. and we say, what does the state need to do to sort of come out of to come out and say, look, we've got great things here in Wisconsin. It's a great place to start a business, and it's a great place to bring a family and raise a family and all the things that come with it.
And you had a kickoff event, appropriately named. I think it was at Lambeau Field or some of the facilities there. Can you talk about what happened there and bringing together those different parties you were talking about?
Well, you know, we were really delighted. We were surprised to find that we had a better-than-expected attendance, almost double attendance. And I think it really speaks to, I guess, the need for change. It also speaks to the desire that the community has for making things improve here in Wisconsin. We had representation from all three groups. We had investors there, we had business leaders there, and we had entrepreneurs, inventors, and businessmen and women there as well. And there were a lot of things going on. We had great content. We had a thing called reverse pitch. Reverse pitch is a thing we brought into the event because we wanted to put corporations up on stage and talk about high-value problems that they were having inside their organization, things that they were looking to solve from outside the borders of the corporate environment. A lot of great ideas and a lot of innovation we know come from outside corporate entities. They know that. We as entrepreneurs know that, and investors know that. So putting this type of content up on stage, which is in contrast to what you might normally see at a startup event, which is an entrepreneur pitching into a room of investors or into an audience of corporate leaders. Kind of flipped it, if you know what I mean.
Talking to John Ernst from the group Launch Wisconsin about efforts to boost startups, entrepreneurial culture here in Wisconsin, northeastern Wisconsin, and elsewhere. Yeah, I really liked, John, that reverse pitch concept. I never would have thought of doing it that way. Is part of the effort here to say, okay, we've got these companies that are here in Wisconsin already. They've got problems they need to solve. Let's try to find the solutions in Wisconsin to, you know, get the economic benefit to that solution here and not, say, Silicon Valley or somewhere.
That's exactly right. One of the things that you'll learn by being an entrepreneur is whether you've come out of the corporate environment or you've never been in the corporate environment, doesn't matter. You look into the company and into that market from the outside and you say, I think I have a solution that that company is dying for a lack of having. But without really understanding what's going on inside, you're not in their day-to-day business. You're on the outside. By inviting those corporations to step out on stage and develop a model from which they can comfortably speak from and say, this is something not only we need to solve, but everyone in our industry needs to solve. And if we can work together in getting that done, everyone wins. So it's very important that this happen. We think it actually is a critical piece of improving the entrepreneurial aspect of the state of Wisconsin and the Midwest and other areas.
I know you're taking a statewide focus, but keying in on northeastern Wisconsin for a moment, you know, Madison, you think of university spinoffs, Epic, things like that. Milwaukee has got the big city opportunities there and a big campus. What do you see as maybe some unique opportunities, unique things that region could get into to complement what's going on in the rest of the state?
Well, I think we have those things as well, and I really want to restate the idea that we think about Wisconsin as a whole. It's so important that when we look at what Madison and Milwaukee has done, they've done great things to contribute to the startup economy, the startup space. They've had all the different kind of resources, universities, corporations, successful corporations, big brands like Harley-Davidson, American Family, Assurant Health. Well, Northeast Wisconsin has got some of that same success. We've got companies like Kimberly-Clark, Appian, Bemis, and Plexus. These are all organizations that, because of their success, there are then individuals that have private success and private wealth as well. This is a resource for the entrepreneurial community to engage and collide and collaborate. So in that sense, we're no different. We're saying, how do we become part of it? Us too, right? It's not like we're better than or have a unique spin on it. Wisconsin is a small place, and the world is, you know, we fit into that picture, that ecosystem, better by working together than trying to be independent.
Now, thinking about cash, investors being willing to support efforts like this, do we have the financial resources here when it comes to venture capital, angel investing, and are they looking outside of places like Madison and Milwaukee?
Well, I think the answer is yes. We've got a lot of cash available in the state as a byproduct of these successful organizations. To name a few, we've got the Wisconsin Super Angel Fund. I think I just heard a comment about the Badger Fund of Funds. They're doing a lot of work to bring money into the state and into entrepreneur activities, as well as organizations like WISC Partners, where this is a group of people who are outside of Wisconsin in Silicon Valley, and they're looking at bringing that cash and to do deals inside of Wisconsin. So we've got a desire and a demand for both in-state funding and out-of-state funding.
Very briefly, John, do you think we're nearing a critical mass where we don't need this kind of cheerleading and matchmaking service where it's just going to kind of take off on its own in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, that's a great question. There's a myth out there that if you say, if you build it, they will come. We kind of come from a different school of thought, and that is you've got to really work at these things. And these things don't take care of themselves on their own. It's by coming together as a community. The entrepreneur community here at Launch Wisconsin has done just that. And they've said if we put our resources together and work together, not only in the Northeast, but with the rest of the state and the rest of the region, we can probably get where we're trying to go.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That's John Ernst, Executive Director of Launch Wisconsin, a new effort to boost startups and entrepreneurship in northeastern Wisconsin and beyond.
If you happen to be looking for a legitimate reason to have a cookie today, you've got it. Today's National Dessert Day, it turns out. I had no idea, but as far as Rob and I are concerned, I guess this means that everybody's got an official go-ahead to have a donut or whatever.
And that naturally, of course, means there are, as always, on days like this, no donuts around WPR reading, which, you know, is odd. Usually somebody has a birthday or a first day or a last day on the job, something that leads somebody to have donuts out on a table in the hallway or
You've been known to prowl the hallways with specifically that mission in mind.
I'm getting exercise and walking around, and who knows what one encounters while walking around.
Usually a donut.
Maybe.
In this case.
Ideally.
Well, so National Dessert Day, which brings me to the deep philosophical question, Rob. If you, Rob Farich, could only have one dessert for the rest of your life, what would that dessert be?
That's hard, because I like almost all of them. I strangely don't think of donuts so much as dessert. They're like a mid-morning, unhealthy, unfulfilling
They're
snack.
They're a 24-hour snack. Okay,
right.
So no donuts. No,
raspberry pie, chocolate cake, apple crisp.
But you're allergic to cinnamon.
You? Right. Well, I make my own apple
crisp. There's no contest. For me, that's easy. It's strawberry shortcake.
Yeah, I like that. But that wouldn't be the one. Sorry.
All right. Well, we diverged there.
All right. Well, share your National Dessert Day dessert. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.